may proceed.
Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors, good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Leonard Myers. I represent the appellant in this case. My co-counsel, Drew Serrett, will be delivering a five-minute rebuttal. Just from a housekeeping perspective, there was an error in our opening brief on page 10. Where in the brief there was a typographical error in stating...
Counsel, would you speak a little bit louder? I have a hard time hearing you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, in the opening brief on page 10, there is a typographical error where it states that that Ms. King had spent over $10,000 in satisfying some bills that she needed to take care of. That amount should have actually been $5,600, or over $5,600 rather than $10,000. It got inadvertently double counted. This case is essentially about a foreclosure that's run amok. The conditions precedent to foreclosure and a deed of trust, the forbearance agreement, and a trustee were all there in place to prevent foreclosure if possible, but it didn't. For these reasons we're about to present, our hope is that the court will reverse the circuit court's decision in ruling on the appellee's demurrers concerning breach of the deed of trust, breach of the forbearance agreement, breach of the trustee's fiduciary duties, rescission, and the rights of the third-party purchaser. To my first point with regard to the breach of the deed of trust, certain HUD regulations were incorporated into the deed of trust as conditions precedent to foreclosure. One said that the lender cannot foreclose if the borrower is less than 3 months behind in their payments. The other says that the lender has to conduct a face-to-face meeting before the borrower is more than 3 months behind. Either way, in this case, Your Honors, VHDA breached the deed of trust regarding these conditions precedent. Such breaches are material because foreclosing without complying with these HUD regulations, these conditions precedent to foreclosure, King lost her home and the equity in her home. These are simply terms in the deed of trust that have to be strictly enforced to prevent the type of injury sustained by Mrs. King in this situation.
Counsel, assume for a minute, for the sake of my question, that she was, in fact, more than 3 months in default. So I want to focus on the lack to have the face-to-face meeting.
Yes, ma'am.
What allegations do you have that show that the lack of having that meeting prevented her from fulfilling her obligations in the deed of trust to bring the indebtedness current? She was in default.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are there any allegations that answer that question?
They are, Your Honor.
What are they?
For a couple of reasons. One is, our contention is that, and as pled in the second amended complaint, she was in a position to cure the arrearage.
No, that's not my question. What right? She didn't have the meeting. How did not having that meeting prevent her from fulfilling her obligations under the deed of trust?
Your Honor, at times when she tried to tender payments, they were rebuffed. At times during telephone conversations with VHDA, with the trustee, in which she used the term, tried to get herself straight with regard to her defaulted
payments. So are you saying that you allege that had she had the meeting, she would have tendered the money during the meeting?
Well, if you
look at... find that allegation in there.
Right. Well, let me answer it like this, and it may be helpful to the court. The appellee's brief, which was the demur to the second amended complaint, which is listed on page 200 of the joint appendix, they actually quote directly from HUD regarding face-to-face meetings and their purpose. And there, quote, face-to-face meetings are intended to determine the cause of the mortgager's default, obtain financial information, establish a repayment plan, and prevent foreclosure by influencing the payment habits of the mortgagor. Well, she didn't have that opportunity. They didn't offer the face-to-face meeting, let alone have one. And had they had that face-to-face meeting, according to HUD, they were obligated to extend to her some sort of payment plan. So by not having this face-to-face meeting, by the lender breaching the conditions precedent to foreclosure by not having this meeting, they essentially withdrew from her a protection that she would normally have had to keep her loan in good standing, or at least bring it up to good standing. So because she didn't have that meeting, and because they foreclosed on her, given the time period, in this situation, the damages flowed directly from the breach.
Aren't you just really saying she didn't have the meeting, they didn't have the right to foreclose, therefore she gets damages? Isn't that what you're saying?
Your Honor, what I'm simply saying is that the terms of the deed of trust must be strictly enforced, just like any other contract. And in the deed of trust, it said that foreclosure cannot happen unless the regulations of the HUD secretary were satisfied. In this situation, they were not. VHDA foreclosed on her without having the face-to-face meeting within 3 months of her default. They didn't have it at all. And had they had that, this whole mess could have possibly been averted.
And counsel, actually, to go back one step before that, acceleration cannot occur without the meeting. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct.
An acceleration has to occur before a foreclosure can rightfully be done.
That is correct, Your Honor. And in this situation, when she called, which leads me to my next point, actually, the forbearance agreement, when she called after the forbearance period, as instructed by VHDA, all they were concerned about was whether she had found full-time employment, which was essentially the purpose for which she attained the forbearance agreement in the first place, because she was trying to find a full-time job and manage her cash flow during that period.
This is not in the record, and I could not figure it out from the record. How does the forbearance agreement come about? Is there a meeting that results in the forbearance agreement, or is this a telephone communication? How is it that she entered into a forbearance agreement looking to salvage her home?
Sure, Your Honor. If I could add some light to that. These are strictly telephone conversations between her and VHDA, between her and her quote-unquote loan modification consultant in trying to save her home. But there was not a physical meeting that occurred that precipitated the forbearance agreement. In that forbearance agreement, there were two terms. One was at the end of the forbearance agreement, which was essentially August 31st, because the next payment would have been September 1st, they either would give her the opportunity to bring the account current by paying it in full, or utilizing some sort of loss mitigation method by which she might be able to get back on track. VHDA did neither of these things. As I mentioned earlier, they asked her has she obtained a full-time job, which she was looking for during the forbearance period. She did not obtain one. She indicated that she was still working her
mortgage. I'm sorry, did you say they did not give her an opportunity to bring her mortgage current?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what I'm saying. And that's what
wasn't that the purpose of the forbearance agreement, to give her an opportunity to bring the mortgage current?
In her particular situation, because she was trying to not exhaust her savings, she asked for a forbearance agreement because she wanted to find a full-time job. And she had, and they agreed to do that.
So they agreed to give her 4 months, at the end of which she would then contact them and pay the arrearage. None of that happened. So I'm not sure if I follow your statement that they didn't give her an opportunity to bring the mortgage current.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what we're saying, and that goes to the heart of our breach of the forbearance agreement. They did not give her an opportunity to pay that amount in full. They did not even tell her what the full amount was at that particular time. Nor did they provide her any sort of mitigation program that could have saved her.
Maybe I'm looking at the wrong document, counsel. On 158, on June 23rd, the back pay amount is $4,114.35.
Yes,
they give her from June until August to not make a payment, and then in August, as I understand this letter, she has to pay the $4,000 plus the amounts that have accrued in the interim.
Yes,
so they've given her an amount. They've given her a date certain. What else were they supposed to do that they didn't do here?
Well, Your Honor, assuming that you take that $4,100 and then you take those months that were forbeared against, which was July through August 2010. That's another $1,850, plus the payments for October, September and October. That comes to a total of approximately $7,800 at the time that they foreclosed on her.
Okay.
That's just a ballpark figure, just given what was in the forbearance agreement, her monthly payment of $925 a month. So when you add all that together at the time they foreclosed on her in October of 2010, it comes to $7,800.
Okay.
Well, Ms. King had $8,800 in her savings account, but they would not allow her to take care of their arrears because they said, well, you didn't find a full-time job. I know these are fantastic facts, Your Honor, but sometimes reality is stranger than fiction.
Did she ever write a check for $7,800, put it in an envelope, and send it to VHDA?
No, Your Honor. She tendered her payment for September and October.
$925 for September and $925 for October.
As she was, and they rejected them and said that she was in foreclosure. That's where we are, Your Honor. I need to yield the balance of my time to my co-counsel.
Sorry to take up your time.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Godfrey Pym. I'm here today on behalf of the appellees, the Virginia Housing Development Authority, and Evans Bryan PLLC. I also want to reserve some time for my co-defense counsel to have an opportunity to speak to the issues. And so, in the interest of time, in lieu of delving into each of the issues that we address in our brief on a piecemeal basis, because I feel that we did properly dissect all the issues as well as critique the assignments of error cited by opposing counsel, I would like to just delve straight to the chase into the pivotal issue. That's why we think that Ms. King's claim here is vitally, or I should say, is flawed based on the facts that are pled. In sum, folks, we would assert that the case is flawed based upon the lack of proof of causation. Everyone from the esteemed justice of this court to those that came before the court earlier.
Counsel, where is causation required in the HUD regulation?
Which HUD regulation are you referring to?
The one that requires a face-to-face meeting.
Well, the face-to-face meeting, as I was about to say, Your Honor, is that with respect to a violation of the legal duty owed, and we're acknowledging that based upon the facts that have been pled, that there would have been a valid allegation with respect to the violation of the legal duty owed. But that in and of itself, Your Honor, quite candidly does not give rise to a claim. Every lawsuit, it's well understood by everyone in here, has three elements, violation of legal duty owed, and proof of causation and resulting damages.
Counsel, in our Bayview mortgage case, are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. There, it was a letter sent by regular mail instead of certified mail.
Correct.
Tell me where the causation was in that case.
Well, I believe that this court found that the trial court found credible evidence that the plaintiff in that particular case did not, in fact, receive the notice of pre-acceleration.
Thereby, the plaintiff in that case did not have the opportunity to cure.
Absolutely.
Okay. And here, what is the purpose of the meeting requirement from HUD?
Well, the purpose is an information-gathering mechanism, as Mr. Myers pointed out. It's solely to ascertain whether or not foreclosure is the only viable recourse option for the lender. It is not the cure-all, the panacea for a delinquent borrower. It is not something, and there is no allegation that's been cited.
It's to exchange information.
It is.
And the information would have shown that that she had $8,800 in her account, or could have shown that, correct?
Well, it was according to, if we'd had a meeting, I guess she could have been able to demonstrate that.
She could have been able, to demonstrate causation, correct?
No.
How could she not?
Because, Your Honor, at this time, or based upon the allegations, there was no allegation with respect to what was the exact amount that would have been due and owing pursuant to her reinstatement rights. And furthermore, at no point is as the court has pointed out, that she ever tendered the amount that was sufficient to reinstate the loan. We don't know if $8,800 would have been sufficient to reinstate or not at that point.
But we would have known if there had been a meeting, would we not?
Well, we would have known if there'd been a meeting, perhaps, but that presupposes that she was not given an opportunity to try to discuss any of her issues with respect to how she could have cured the arrearage with VHDA.
Excuse me. Chief, the clock isn't working.
Oh. Madam Clerk, the clock isn't working. The clock isn't working. Thank you. I didn't notice.
I'm sorry.
I thought it started working.
Counsel, why don't you go into your next question?
I have a question to follow up on that. We're talking about, or your point is, that there is no proof of causation. She has alleged causation. We're at demur. How do we, on a demur, address whether there is proof. She's alleged that there was causation. Doesn't that get her past demur?
Well, I believe that the trial court rightfully looked at this case and did not take the allegations that were alleged at face value. Because it is...
And what is the basis for not taking allegations at face value on demur?
Excellent question. The reason being, quite candidly, Your Honor, is that the notion that has been made in an effort to create this causational link between the failure to provide the face-to-face meeting and the resulting damage to the quote-unquote loss of the home was to assert that we were denied, rebuffed, or precluded from, if you will, from exercising the right to reinstatement. However, that is in direct contradiction, as can be reconciled quite candidly with the express terms of the deed of trust. The deed of trust provides Ms. King with a unilateral, if almost unqualified, right to reinstate that was not contingent upon any action taken by VHJ or Evans and Bryant. Now, there has been some allegations made by Ms. King's counsel in their opposition brief to our demur to the Second Amendment complaint that she did, in fact, request a reinstatement quote of Evans and Bryant. Perhaps if that had happened, then that would be sufficient grounds to at least sue on the basis that we failed to acknowledge her reinstatement rights. Why even go through the notion of we denied her right to face-to-face meeting? At that particular point, it's a very, very easy case to state that we had a right of reinstatement that was denied because we were not even given a quote. I would think, Your Honor, quite candidly, that that is not the case here. It was not alleged here, and in the scope of this particular court's examination with regard to the
demur. So there were two conditions precedent, and the demur should be granted because only one of the conditions precedent was pleaded?
Well, I don't quite understand the question, Your Honor.
You say she had a right to reinstate.
Correct.
In the deed of trust.
Yes.
That was a condition precedent to foreclosure, correct?
Well, no. Well, quite candidly, Your Honor, where I believe that Ms. King misses the point is that the foreclosure proceedings were not initiated because we did not provide her with a face-to-face meeting. The foreclosure proceedings were initiated because she was not in current on her loan.
You could not accelerate without a face-to-face meeting under the HUD regulations. Is that correct?
Well, that commence foreclosure proceedings.
No.
I don't know whether or not commencement of foreclosure would include the definition of acceleration.
When you look at the HUD regulations, were you permitted to accelerate the debt without the face-to-face meeting?
We're not permitted to commence foreclosure proceedings. I don't know what is defined as foreclosure proceedings. I would submit that we were not able to appoint the substitute trustee to initiate the sale. To commence foreclosure proceedings, quite candidly, is what is stated. We cannot commence foreclosure proceedings without providing a face-to-face meeting opportunity before she's 3 months in arrears.
You did not provide the face-to-face meeting?
We did not.
So how can you go to foreclosure?
Well, we're entitled to go for foreclosure. Well, again, the mere violation of a legal duty owed, Your Honor, I would submit is not sufficient to give rise to a cognizable claim for recovery of equitable relief or monetary damages. Again, there's three elements to every
loss. Counsel, she has alleged those damages. This is at the demurrer stage.
Yes,
Your Honor. You're making a trial argument now.
No, I'm not making a trial argument. I'm merely saying that the trial court's ruling should be upheld because the trial court felt that the allegation, the mere naked and unsubstantiated allegation that she was precluded from exercising her rights to reinstatement, yet did not tender the reinstatement amount to cure the arrearage, nor to any allegation to even request a reinstatement quote, I believe were valid to find that there was not a valid basis alleged to support a claim for the recovery of the damages that she's seeking. Again, there are three elements to every case, and the violation of legal duty owed here, the violation of the face-to-face meeting obligation, in and of itself alone, is not sufficient to give rise to a claim. Again, the allegation that she was quote-unquote precluded from exercising her rights of reinstatement are inconsistent with the fact that the deed of trust provided her with an unqualified and unilateral right to go forward and to pay whatever she owed to stave off foreclosure. She failed to do that. By failing to exercise the rights within her control, the court found that she could not establish that there was proximate causation between the violation that we allegedly committed and the resulting damages. And so that's where we have the problem. Quite candidly, Your Honor, the trial court probably, you know, saw beyond their faults and saw their needs in this particular case. Again, we are supposed to look at the allegations as pled and assuming them to be true or drawing reasonable inferences therefrom. But in this particular instance, Your Honor, you've got to think about it. Let's go back to one of the allegations that they made. One of the bases for the violation was the determination that we had initiated or commenced foreclosure proceedings in November of 2010. Well, obviously, we didn't ultimately sell the property until October of 2011, but one of the allegations was we commenced foreclosure proceedings in November of 2010, which would have been premature under the terms of they're saying because we should have suspended the arrearage amount that was owed during the forbearance period for however long, but there was 3 months that they were claiming were not due and owing at that time. Well, not only is that, to me, immaterial because ultimately the foreclosure sale did not occur in terms of a causal connection, but also is belied by the fact that she had also sought bankruptcy protection to stave off the foreclosure in January. And she also dismissed those proceedings in an effort to qualify for loan modification. Those facts have to be reconciled with the notion that she was ready, willing, and able at all times relevant to reinstate the loan. And again, I mean, it's not so much that, you know, this court has to delve into these tribal issues, but at the same time, the court must only draw reasonable inferences from the facts that have been alleged. And I would submit, Your Honor, that it was not reasonable to infer that anyone who is owed money would tell somebody that they're not going to tell them how much is owed. And that's their allegation. And so I think the court saw beyond that and said...
How could it not be reasonable? That is their allegation. Now, if it turns out that there is no basis, then we have mechanisms for false allegations in pleadings to be dealt with. But how can the court completely dismiss that allegation on demur simply by saying, I don't think anybody would reasonably do that? Well, a whole lot of trial practice is based upon unreasonable actions.
That's fair, Your Honor. And I would submit, Your Honor, quite candidly, that I imputed that determination to the court. But at the end of the day, you know, I think that the court did view the facts as alleged and saw that there were glaring omissions. Again, this notion that they tried to establish the causal connection between the denial of the face-to-face meeting and their opportunity to demonstrate that they, in fact, would have been able to cure their arrearage had they been provided said meeting. Well, this court has already alluded to the fact in the Matthews case that, you know, the face-to-face meeting is not necessarily the objectives of those meetings unless have to be achieved through an actual in-person interaction. In that particular case, it alluded to the notion that a branch office can have a telephone conversation to achieve the same goal.
But that was not a distinction that the trial court made in granting the demur.
I know, but my point being is here is that this...
We can only base our ruling upon what the trial court did in denying the demur.
Well, that's fair. And it denied the demur based upon the allegations that were pled. And the allegations that were pled here, Your Honor, quite candidly, was that there were ongoing discussions ever since the conclusion of the forbearance period in September of 2010 with the VHDA. With respect to her loan status. All along, Ms. King understood and recognized that she was in default. Yet and still, she did not do anything that was within her control, vis-a-vis the deed of trust, to reinstate the loan, to request a reinstatement amount, or anything along those lines. Now what she's doing is seeking a self-serving retroactive excuse to immunize herself from the consequences of default. The court said that that's not going to be sufficient by hanging your hat on the failure to provide a face-to-face when you cannot demonstrate that you're ready, willing, and able to reinstate the loan at the time of commencement of foreclosure.
Counsel, what authority do you have for allowing a foreclosure to go forward when there has been the failure of a condition precedent? Is there any authority that you can cite to that proposition?
Well, what I would submit, Your Honor, is quite candidly that the court's ruling in Matthews did not vitiate the basic principles of law with respect to the proof of proximate causation.
Okay.
And that's my authority.
But, counsel, we are not dealing with proof on demur. What authority do you have for a demur being granted when a condition precedent, when both parties admit that a condition precedent failed? Do you have any authority?
Well, I would establish, Your Honor, that the authority is the well-established and axiomatic principles of this court, which establishes that there's three basic elements to any lawsuit. And I would
not say, any lawsuit, a breach of contract.
A breach of contract. And my point being is this. If Your Honor,
they have alleged causation, correct?
They've alleged causation, Your Honor, but the reason why...
They may not be able to prove causation, but they have alleged it. What more do they have to do on demur?
Well, Your Honor, again, they have to allege sufficient facts to demonstrate that there was a causal link. That's the key here. They're not sufficient facts. I can go out here and say that, yes, I was ready, willing, and able to reinstate. When in fact, and again, as I pointed out...
It was less than $8,800 due that was in arrears. Is that correct?
That is not correct. If the court were to look at the affirmative defenses that we filed to her initial lawsuit, which mind you
how much did your affirmative defenses show? Does the record show was due prior to the 3 months?
I asserted in our affirmative defenses to the initial complaint where she first alleged that she was current on the mortgage, which is why she said it should be defeated.
What does the record show?
There was over $15,000.
How much?
Over $15,000 due at the time of the commitment.
Okay.
Foreclosure.
Over $15,000, and she had almost $9,000 in a bank account.
As a she
could the court reasonably conclude that she was unwilling and unable to come up with an additional $6,000 from some source in order to protect more than $100,000 of equity?
Well, Your Honor, let me ask you a question.
No, counsel. Okay. I want you to answer my question.
If you look at the allegations that she made, she did a whole lot of things to stave off foreclosure and to qualify for one, quote-unquote loan modification. One of the things that she did was she paid her electric bill. Now, I would submit to the court that I wouldn't pay my electric bill before I pay my house note. Now, we can come up with a whole lot of reasons retroactively and after the fact as to why I should be immunized from the consequences of my default.
Counsel, this is a great closing argument. This does not establish how the judge was able to make that ruling on demurrer, which is precisely what I just asked you for.
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that with respect to what you all ruled in Matthews, that was a deck action in which they enjoined a prospective sale.
I did not ask for the distinction between Matthews. Somebody else might ask that.
Right.
That was not my question.
Well, my point being is that on demurrer, apparently Judge Martin did not feel that there were sufficient facts pled to establish a causal link because of their inability to demonstrate that they had the ability to do what they claimed they were going to do based upon the omitted facts with respect to their request for reinstatement.
We will never know because there wasn't a meeting where those facts could have been exchanged.
Well, the facts could have been exchanged via telephone as well,
Indeed, counsel, are you alleging that in this case there was a telephone conference that was sufficient to be in lieu of the meeting?
They've acknowledged that in support of their claim for the breach of the special forbearance agreement that we had a conversation with her, I believe, in May of 2010, and told her that she did not qualify for loan modification because of...
Was that the basis for the demurrer being granted?
Well,
no.
I would
submit... I'll answer that one. It was not.
Well,
counsel, when is a telephone conversation permitted in lieu of a meeting under Matthews?
Well, Your Honor...
When is it permitted in lieu of a meeting under Matthews?
Oh, under Matthews? Yes. You all alluded to it in, I believe it was Victor, perhaps maybe a concurring decision, but it may not... At the end of the case... It was talking about, you guys were talking about the distinction between this branch office and this notion of saying that, look, that sometimes you could facilitate the very purpose of a face-to-face meeting doing it by a telephone.
Because it is difficult for the borrower and the lender to get together due to the geographic conditions or other factors. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Was that present here? Is there a finding that was present here?
Well, Your Honor, no.
Counsel, where was the office?
It's here in Richmond.
Okay. Where was she?
She's in Norfolk.
Do your loan officers ever go to Norfolk?
Well, that's an issue that we have concerns about because we believe that quite candidly an unwarranted scrutiny of the trial court's decision in this particular case, which is solely and narrowly tailored to the facts of this particular case, not an universal pronouncement, which I believe they're trying to make with respect to the overall rights of borrowers and obligations.
Counsel, did you allege that it was either impossible or impractical to have a face-to-face meeting?
I don't allege that. I just allege that the failure to provide a face-to-face meeting was not the cause of her claim damage. That's in the nutshell, the lack of proof of proximate causation. And I didn't give enough time to co-counsel, so I'll submit that. Sit down.
Okay.
I'm Scott Carnes. I represent A.J. Potter Investments, LLC, the purchaser at the foreclosure auction. And with us today is Mark Bowman, who's counsel for Monarch Bank, who financed my client's purchase of the foreclosure auction. And given the shortness of time, I'd like to point out that with respect to folks in the position of my client, we can't know whether there's been a meeting or should have been a meeting or any of that. We can only deal with what's a matter of record. We can't be calling up VHDA and asking about people's delinquencies or non-delinquencies. They can't talk to us about that. The General Assembly has told us that when there's a notice of foreclosure sale given pursuant to 55-59.1, the giving of that notice shall be deemed an effective exercise of any right of redemption. I understand perfectly what the CFR regulations say with regard to face-to-face meeting vis-a-vis the right of redemption, but from the perspective of the buyer at the foreclosure auction, we're told by the General Assembly that if there's been a notice of foreclosure sale, you're entitled to assume that there's been an effective exercise of the right of acceleration. And we're told further on in that statute.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt you, but you all have already had more than 15 minutes, so your time's expired.
I realize that. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Thank you.
I don't know how much time had expired, but I think that they'd been talking at least 5 minutes when we realized the clock wasn't running, so I'll add 5 minutes to your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Drew Surrett. I'm one of the counsel for the appellants. I want to address briefly something Mr. Penn said in his argument, which was that in October 2011, the $15,000 is what was due on the mortgage to cure the arrearage. That was what was asserted in their affirmative defenses. There are allegations in the complaint that she first made contact with VHDA shortly after the forbearance agreement expired and asked what she could do to reinstate the loan, and was advised by VHDA that she couldn't reinstate the loan because she had not obtained full-time employment. Whether someone obtains part-time or full-time employment is completely irrelevant to the issue of whether or not they should be entitled to reinstate on the loan. There are additional allegations that around the same time she called Evans and Bryant and asked for an opportunity to be allowed to reinstate the loan and was rebuffed. There are additional allegations that in 2011, approximately 5 months before the foreclosure sale, she again called Evans and Bryant and asked if she would be given the opportunity to reinstate and was told that there was nothing she could do. That leads me to the question of the claim for the breach of fiduciary duty. I submit to the Court that the averments in the Second Amendment complaint established a claim for breach of fiduciary duty against Evans and Bryant that was sufficient to survive demur. She pled that she called Evans and Bryant and inquired, what can I do? I would like to reinstate the loan, and indicated that she had this amount of money and was told there's nothing she could do. That was not within Evans and Bryant's power to advise her that there was nothing she could do to reinstate the loan. The loan documents provided the deed of trust that she would be afforded the opportunity to reinstate. The fact that she didn't ask for a reinstatement quote, I think can in part be chalked up to she's a layperson. She's calling the trustee, the person that's in a position of authority to handle the foreclosure sale, and is saying, what can I do to correct this situation? I have this much money. And what she's told by that person in a position of authority is that there's nothing she could do. I submit that under the case law of this court, Preston v. Johnson, the trustee owes a duty of impartiality to both sides. And in making that statement, in essence, looking out for the interests of VHDA and saying that, well, they want to go ahead with the foreclosure, presumably, and saying there's nothing she can do, he breached, Evans and Bryant breached their duty to treat her with perfect fairness and impartiality. And perfect fairness and impartiality is a direct quote from a case of this court, which is Powell v. Adams, from 1942. As for the contention that the purchaser at the foreclosure sale did not have any notice of the challenge prior to the sale, we've alleged in the complaint, in the second amended complaint, that she contacted an agent of that purchaser and advised him that the matter was in litigation. Now, of course, that statement was not correct. But it was not artful, but it conveyed from her position that she was challenging the foreclosure sale, and we submit put them on notice. Now, I acknowledge to the court that the claim against the third-party purchaser is not as strong as the claim for damages based on the breach of the deed of trust, the breach of the forbearance agreement.
And in fact, if the third-party purchaser is a bona fide purchaser for value, then the claim has no merit at all.
Your Honor, if the third party, that's correct, Your Honor. If it's found that the third party purchaser is a bona fide purchaser for value, there is not a claim for rescission of the foreclosure. There's not a claim against that party for rescission of the foreclosure. It's our position that the combination of her statements to the agent of the third party purchaser and the price of the foreclosure sale put the third-party purchaser on notice that there could potentially be a challenge to this foreclosure sale.
But as the trial court found, even if they had searched the records, there would have been nothing to support her allegation, which you yourself have said was not correct. And so how could that possibly render them not a bona fide purchaser?
Well, Your Honor, when I guess the question of records is searching the land records. There was not a Liz Pendens recording.
They had gone down to the courthouse and, in response to her statement, looked for a lawsuit. There would not have been one. So they have a bare assertion that I'm going to fight this. Are you suggesting that that's enough to take them from under the umbrella of being a bona fide purchaser?
Our position, in which I stated, was that the combination of being notified that they're, hey, I this is in litigation, which was her way of saying, in our position, that she was going to challenge the foreclosure sale, and a purchase price, which is half of the assessed value, is an allegation sufficient to survive demurrer that party may be on notice that there's something wrong with this foreclosure sale. When the borrower comes in and
is there, and again, I'm sorry to continue to be asking for authority. Do you have any authority, any legal authority, any case law that would support that?
Your Honor, I think this particular issue is a question of first impression, of whether is someone coming up prior to the sale and making a statement that we acknowledge is not correct, and then that combined with the purchase price, which is less or approximately half of the assessed value, that there's not support for that particular.
The purchase price doesn't shock the conscience of the court, and I'm assuming we're talking about the court here on demurrer, and the court said he was not shocked by this. The authority is the price has to shock the conscience of the court. And so there is authority on the point. The authority is that there has to be constructive or actual notice. And so there is authority on that point.
But, Your Honor, if the allegation was merely that the price was so low as to shock the conscience of the court that the sale should be overturned, it would be correct that there's case law from this court, I think, with a purchase price that was one-third of the assessed value, a purchase price that was less than half of the assessed value, that alone is not sufficient to establish that the person is not a good faith purchaser for value. What we have here, in addition to the amount of the purchase price, is that prior to the foreclosure sale, the borrower advised an agent of the potential purchaser that she was going to challenge a sale, or that she believed there was something wrong with it, that it was in litigation.
Wouldn't your position allow any borrower to taint a foreclosure sale by going and making allegations, I'm going to fight this, there's something wrong here?
Well, I think that with the specific facts of this case, there's a combination of the purchase price. In many foreclosure, there's a combination of the low purchase price, which is about half of the assessed value, with the statement before. In many foreclosure sales, the purchase price, the lender bids it in. When you have a third party coming in, they're purchasing that property at foreclosure because there's significant equity in the property. Otherwise, they wouldn't have any interest in doing so. And when the borrower, in a situation like that, advises that the case, that they're going to challenge it, I submit that the defendant can't then be shocked that they're brought into court after that foreclosure sale.
Let me ask you this. Assume, and that's a big assumption, but assume the court were to agree insofar as the demurrer on the other side of this case, I call, but not agree as to the bona fide purchaser issue. Could the borrower still not recover, or at least have the opportunity to recover damages as a result of that foreclosure sale?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. When the I think the borrower would still be able to recover damages. If the court found that the borrower had not pled a claim to rescind the foreclosure sale or to quiet title, the borrower would have, if the court remanded on the issue of breach of contract and breach of fiduciary duty and breach of the forbearance agreement, she would still have a claim for compensatory damages. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Your time is expired.
Thank you.
The court is adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.